I'll call the Public Safety Finance Division to order. Members, our agenda today is such. We're going to finish up with the governor's recommendations for the Department of Corrections. We've also asked for labor, both AFSCME and MAEP, to address the current governor's recommendations and sort of the state of affairs at DOC. And then we've asked the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections, Minnesota Corrections Association, and the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers to talk not just about this budget recommendation, but also just sort of where things are at based on what we did last year relative to their budget and caseloads. And we will also allow some public testimony at the after those presentations, and that will be it. So we left off. Commissioner, do you want to? I think we left off that we didn't talk about the offender vocational education reductions, for the community service reductions, for reentry programs, and the transfer from MNCOR and the special revenue fund. So, or if there's anything that we didn't touch on last week that you'd like to touch on first, feel free to.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is David Christ. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Facilities at the Department of Corrections. As I recall, I had finished my presentation on offender education vocational issues, and I was about to move on to MNCOR, and with the leave of the chair, I'll do that.
Very good. Thank you.
Just a little background on the MNCOR program. MNCOR Prison Industries have been operating in the Minnesota Department of Corrections going back to the early 1900s. About 10 or 15 years ago, the Department of Corrections had been subsidizing the MNCOR program to the tune of about $6 million a year in order for that program to operate. Around 1995 or thereabouts, the legislature directed that we make MNCOR a self-sufficient program, that whatever money the program earned should cover the costs of the program, and we were given a five-year plan in order to do that. We succeeded in becoming self-sufficient with that program a little bit earlier than the five-year plan, and the program has been self-sufficient ever since, with revenues exceeding expenses since that time. The last year in the biennial budget, the MNCOR program was assessed $1 million each year for directly to the general fund to help with the budget crisis. And this year, the governor proposes to transfer $574,000 in fiscal 10 and $989,000 in fiscal 11 to help with the budget problem. These would be one-time cash reductions to the MNCOR revolving account. It would come out of the money that MNCOR has made. There are three staff vacancies in the program right now, and we anticipate three other vacancies in fiscal 11 due to retirements or general turnover in the program. And those positions would be held open as well. Because we receive no general fund appropriation for the MNCOR program anymore, when we've got vacancies, when we hold them over, that cost goes right to the bottom line of the program, and we would help pay for the reductions out of that money.
So, Commissioner, I mean, what will this mean to MNCOR? I mean, it's six less employees to the overall function of the operation. What changes might we expect?
Mr. Chair, members, I think that we can operate business as usual even with this reduction in MNCOR. We're not expecting any changes. We're still on a goal to increase offender assignments through the Min Corps program. The economy is a question right now, but even in the tough year of 2009 and so far in 2010, revenues are exceeding expenses there, and we don't foresee any real changes.
For those who have not seen any of the Min Corps operations, can you just tell us briefly what's produced?
Mr. Chair, members, you might be sitting on one of the products that's produced by Min Corps. We've got a seating industry there, and I know that we've supplied the legislature with some of the chairs for the hearing rooms. We do metal products where we make a variety of different products for different companies. For instance, 3M buys heavy metal racks that they put large spools of adhesive tape and sandpapers and abrasives on to move around their factories. We do wood products where we make dormitory furniture for instance, we had a project with the University of Minnesota recently. We make library tables that are in many of our high schools around the state. We do light assembly.
Can I just ask people if they have their cell phones on, even in the audience, to turn them off? It's interfering with the sound system. Thank you. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Commissioner.
We do a variety of light assembly projects. And
where's our staff?
Somebody doesn't want me to finish, Mr. Chair.
No, that's not true. Does anyone have their cell phone out? All right, let's try it again.
I'll just finish up by saying one of our biggest product areas is license plates for the state of Minnesota.
And one more question, Commissioner. So is there any way to track, like, the skills that inmates get from working in Min Corps to see if it's transferable when they're released, or is that not something you look at?
Mr. Chair, members, I think we're doing that. One of the reentry programs that is funded out of Min Corps proceeds is called Employ, and it's a program where we connect offenders who have worked in Min Corps and are released with jobs, employers in real businesses in Minnesota. And so we are able to track the offenders that go through that program and succeed in getting jobs and succeed after they're released in keeping those jobs that are that pay much higher than a subsistence wage when they get out.
Questions, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. I heard you say that there's three and three, so there's a total of six positions that will be held open through next year.
Commissioner Crist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes, sir.
And, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Commissioner, that's by leaving those six positions open, that will totally fund the $1.5 million in production?
Commissioner Crist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, no. That's a portion of the money, and the rest of it would come out of cash from the revolving fund in Min Corps.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Commissioner, what portion of the $1.5 million would have been used to compensate or pay for those six positions over those 2 years?
Commissioner Crist.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, doing the math quickly in my head, if those positions were about $70,000 each with benefits, it would be about $420,000 a year.
Representative Smith?
Nothing further at this time, thank you.
Anything else on Min Corps, Representative House?
Just a short question. When the prison buys from Min Corps, how do they know that they're getting a competitive price and then that they couldn't buy from the outside cheaper and save in their individual budgets.
Ms. Cornelius?
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Lisa Cornelius, Assistant Commissioner for Operations Support. Representative Hawes, our buyers will get bids from other companies if they believe that there is a price comparison offer there. We are not mandated to buy from MinCorp. However, we think it's a great idea to buy from MinCorp because we believe in the philosophy of keeping our offenders employed. But if we do believe that we can get a much better price elsewhere, we will bid that out and make sure.
And
Representative Hawes.
Mr. Chair, thank you. A few years ago, people within the system were complaining about that and feeling very uncomfortable, and whether directly forced or indirectly forced, were feeling that they had to buy from MinCorp. Do you think that feeling is reduced now?
Commissioner Cornelius.
Representative Paymar, Chair Paymar, Representative Hawes. Sometimes I believe it's that our staff don't always have all the information. We actually changed the purchasing rules on that, I would guess, 4 or 5 years ago. So oftentimes it just takes time for everyone to realize that the purchasing staff maybe don't share all that information as upfront as they should. I do think the attitude has changed some, yes.
May I have one more follow-up
please.
Question? Usually in purchasing of materials, it is traditional that you get a more than one price. Would that be true when you're purchasing materials?
Commissioner Cornelius.
Chair Paymar, if I'm clear, are you saying when MinCorp is buying materials or when the department?
When the prison is buying the materials.
When the prison is?
Yes.
Yes, it is true that we would get more than one bid.
And then may I? I'm sorry, I just want to do this just for a minute. So if you're purchasing from MinCorp, then there would be a sheet that also that would be giving a price from another producer, consumer,
Commissioner Cornelius.
Product maker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hawes, I'm guessing not in every single situation. We are not required to do that, and neither are other state agencies. We
right.
can buy direct from MinCorp without getting bids. However, when we believe that there are places out there where we can maybe get a better price, it's to our best interest to get bids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Testifier.
Representative Kelly has a question.
Mr. Chair, this is more of a comment. I just wanted to say I appreciate the Commissioner's first response to your question when you asked what the effect of this transfer is going to be on MinCorp, and the Commissioner's first response is we can handle it. I guess in these times, of a lot of times governments, seems like we have this idea of we use it or lose it budget, but I think understanding six positions be held open, but I certainly appreciate, and it's refreshing to hear you say we can handle this. Thank you.
Okay, is there anything else on MinCorp that you would like to?
No, sir.
Okay. All right, so what next do we have with corrections here, Commissioner? Do you want to speak to this transfer to the from the Special Revenue Fund, Commissioner Cornelius?
Mr. Chair, I will speak to that. We did miss the operating budget reduction, which I would also like to speak to.
Oh, please do.
This is a cut of $539,000 the first year and $1.078 million the second year. This is considered an agency-wide cut. You know, as you know, we're a large and complex agency. We haven't totally specified what this cut is going to be yet. You know, as we looked at all of our unencumbered funds and we looked at historically how much we've canceled each year, we thought this was a feasible amount to cut out of our budget. We're going to be looking at positions that we've held open for long periods of time due to underfunded salaries. And we're also looking at some operational efficiencies. And we need a little time to work through some of those to figure out for sure which ones are going to get us the best bang for our buck. For example, one of them is an automated offender base file system, and we have received some federal grant money to automate all of our offender base files, and we do think that this can possibly reduce some positions, perhaps in the records area. So that's one example of what we may do in that area.
Okay.
And then the transfer from the Special Revenue Fund, $201,000 the first year and $402,000 in the second year. We have probably between 25 and 30 different special revenue funds. None of them are very big. They're things like use of facilities, when we rent beds to the feds, which we do very, very little of right now because we don't have any beds. Inmates are charged a 10% cost of confinement fee on top of any money order that comes in from the streets. We have health care co-payments there. We have costs for meal tickets that we sell to staff. We also have indirect costs. When we manage federal money, we get an overhead indirect cost for that. So the funding is coming out of that area. We do think we'll be able to manage this cut, not necessarily each account individually, but as a whole, we'll be able to manage this cut, and it is just one time.
Okay, very good. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we ask a question of the whole presentation that we've even...
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioners, thank you for your two-day testimony. It's been very enlightening. And since our last meeting, I received an email. I want to go back to sentence to serve, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Please do.
I received an email from a couple of my constituents, you know, that said... the Sense to Serve program has significantly helped our city, our Boy Scouts of America, our Chamber of Commerce, our churches. It has saved us significant dollars. Reducing Sense to Serve is going to put it back on the cities and the counties and other government entities. We've been foolish and fiscally irresponsible because this program has proven itself over the last several years. And as I looked at that email, the more concerned I got, and I went back and looked, and in fact, in the corrections and reductions, Sense to Serve in 1011 is taking care of about 62% of the reduction, and then 1213 is taking about 67% of the reduction, if my records are figures are accurate. So I just want to revisit and reemphasize the fact that a program that saves our local government entities significant dollars and our local nonprofits as well, and also does something for the participants. There's some enhancement of the participants, in my opinion. You know, I would encourage us to really be careful with that, I guess, and relook at it and revisit it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mears, did you want to comment or respond?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ken Mears, and I'm a director with the Community Services Division. And all I would say, Representative Ward, is we agree completely with you. We think STS was a wonderful program. When it was initiated, it was an idea of the Department of Corrections to partner with local government and with the local sheriffs to help with the overcrowding in their jails at that time. And it's been a wonderful program for both the locals and for us, not only in the product that they did, but the public relations that we were able to accomplish also with the program. However, when times are like they are now, priorities need to be set, and we have to look at the entire operation. And when you're talking about this big of a cut, there are only certain areas that you can look at, and the priorities were established, and the decision had to be made.
Representative Ward.
Nothing.
Before we leave corrections for now, Commissioner Chris, can you just say a little bit about, we've talked about this before and trying to make reductions about the where you would say our efficiencies are relative to inmate health care. It seems that some of the research seems to indicate that we pay a significant amount more than other, and I don't know if we're comparing apples and apples or apples and oranges like per diem, but compared to other states, you know, maybe that's a good thing, maybe it's not, but is there anything new that you can share with the committee about, oh, we have someone new.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to defer to Nan Larson, who is the Health Services Director for the Department of Corrections.
Okay. Ms. Larson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Nanette Larson. I'm the Health Services Director for the Department of Corrections. And actually, I think we have done a really good job over the past 5 years of negotiating a contract with a healthcare management company to keep our costs relatively low. In fact, one of the years, our actual contract costs decreased by about 0.1%. So our inflationary increases are considerably less than what you're seeing in the general public. We use managed care principles in our system. Probably 80% of our health care is provided on-site. Correctional Medical Services, which is the entity with whom we contract, they contract with community-based providers. They negotiate discounted rates for us. They purchase pharmaceuticals in bulk purchasing on behalf of about 250,000 offenders. So we're getting really good rates on our pharmaceuticals. We're getting discounted rates on our inpatient, outpatient, and specialty care, and plus we're providing lots of care on site. With respect to efficiencies, certainly there's always more that you can do. We're looking at better utilizing telemedicine. One avenue that we're exploring is using cameras in our exam rooms and connecting them with ER docs or on-call docs so that we can eliminate some of our ER runs. We have probably 33 ER runs per month across the system, and so we figured that that may be able to save us some dollars. One of the efficiencies that we did recently, well, actually a little bit more than recently, is we started providing dialysis on site. We have about 10 offenders right now who are on dialysis. And for those of you who are familiar with dialysis, it means 3 times a week, 2 officers with that offender for 4 to 5 hours every time. So we provide dialysis on site. We're providing, it's saving the taxpayers tremendous amounts of money. But we're looking to do some other things like that. We'd like to be able to look at providing chemotherapy on site. We have a lot of cancers in our system. And to the extent that we can provide chemotherapy on site rather than taking the offender off site, we want to do that. So.
Okay, just maybe at some point we could have some more discussion on that, because I'm just looking at how we rank again. I'll make this document that I have available to the committee, but it looks, at least by the 30 or 35 states that are reporting, Minnesota looks like it's ranked, has higher health care costs per inmate, all but for 3 states. And that seems to be due at least because of inflation, and I'm not sure why that's, how that's factored in. But I will make a copy of this document and give it to the committee. So I appreciate the work that you're doing, but you know, I don't want to deprive any of our inmates of proper health care, but we have to look, as you are doing, at all efficiencies.
Mr. Chair, one point, when comparing us with other states, many states use their university hospital systems. Many departments of corrections use their university hospital systems, and they're not charged by their university hospital systems. We don't use ours. Obviously, our university system is owned by Fairview. We wouldn't have that opportunity probably to not get charged. But we do glean some discounts through our partnerships with our community-based hospitals. But so that's one piece, I think, that would be different with other states than it is with the state of Minnesota. So they may not be paying for their inpatient, outpatient hospital costs. I know Oklahoma does that. I know the state of Wisconsin has a pretty deep discount. The other piece in all of this, many states have the authority to reimburse at Medicaid rates. While the Department of Corrections has the authority to reimburse our outside providers at Medicaid rates, we worry about the access issue, as I'm sure you all very well know, with respect to Rule 101 and how that impacts on state employees and workers' comp. So one of the initiatives that we have been talking about is actually, do we want to start reimbursing our community providers at MA rates? The downside to that is obviously decrease in access. we would absolutely need to have some statutory guarantee that if we were going to do that, that our offenders would be seen by the providers in the community, because we need those, that specialty care.
Okay. I don't know if these questions are on health care or DOC budget in general, but we have Representatives Severson, Lesh, and Liebling.
Severson. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This regards the STS provision. I don't know if we want to jump off of this particular topic.
No,
now.
Go ahead.
Okay. And I just, Mr. Chair, just received a phone call from some from one of my towns or cities in my district yesterday, talking about the STS and how much of a benefit that was to their particular area. So I wasn't real familiar with the setup of the program. My understanding is that the judge has the opportunity to allow a service to the community in lieu of a sentencing. And I guess I'm wondering where the administrative costs come in for the overhead that we're cutting on this. My concerns would be that in the out years, if we're reducing the program by 2/3, is that going to carry on in the tails that go out? And then is that going to result in increased number of bed requirements because we are no longer allowing them to serve in a community, but rather incarcerating them? And so I guess those would be questions for the commissioner or someone.
Mr. Mears.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the way the program works is if it is a state-run crew, that means that it's the crew leader is a state employee. And we will pay all of the costs up front for the crew leader, for the equipment, and so forth. And then we would bill the county back for 50%. We have an agreement with the county that they would then reimburse us 50% of that cost. If the crew is what is called a county crew, it's the opposite. The crew leader is a county employee. They pay all the upfront costs, and then they bill the state, and we reimburse them 50% of the cost of the crew leader, equipment, and so forth.
Severson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a kind of a follow-up on that, I guess, and just in terms of awarding from the judges, is this typically a two-for-one? In other words, if there are 2 days of incarceration is for 1 day, or and is that an 8-hour day? And then just a follow-on question would be, is there resistance met from the state unions in terms of this program, or are they okay with this program?
Mr. Mears.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, the statute allows for every 2 days that a county, and again, these are not state offenders, these are not prison offenders, these are county offenders serving their time in the county jail. And the statute allows for every 2 days that they serve on an SDS crew, which would be an 8-hour day out on the crew, they get 1 day off of their sentence.
Representative Severson.
And just to the second question, Mr. Chair, the issue of you know, I think probably all of us have driven along the road and seen trash out on the road and kind of go, well, how come we don't just have offenders out there picking up this stuff? And one of the responses I've received in the past is that some of the state unions have been in opposition because those are state jobs. Can you respond to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, to the best of my knowledge, wherever the crews operate, they work in conjunction with the local units of government and so forth, and the jobs that they are doing are jobs that just would not get done if these crews were not doing them, that there are not other people that are employed or being, you know, left out of work because these people are doing the work in their place. They're jobs that just would not get done otherwise.
And just one follow-up, Mr. Chair. Yeah. And my city administrator, I asked him, well, what do some of these people do? And they said, well, they may dig out the snow around the fire hydrants and some of the other things that, as you say, probably would not get done. And my concerns here is that the net effect would be an increased cost to the counties because they would have to contract that, which would not affect the state budget, so I think that's another thing to take into consideration here as well, Mr. Chair.
In what way?
Well, I mean, it would be nice to be able to continue that program, not cut it so drastically in the future, but again, we're going to have to find the dollar someplace else.
Did you have a question to this point?
Yes, sir.
Okay, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess when you were talking about how the split
is from the reimbursement standpoint. And I, along with Representative Ward, have heard a number of issues and concerns from the locals. Would it be possible, as opposed to cutting the program, is look at that reimbursement rate? If the counties and the locals see that as a great benefit, as it was put to me, we can't hire. I mean, there's no way we could get those jobs done. But as opposed to cutting the program, could we look at possibly increasing the reimbursement rate, or selectively, if the counties wanted to do that? That way, they could keep the program intact for what they see the benefit of, and the state would receive their money.
Mr. Chair and Representative, of course, that would be an option, but whatever money did not get cut, then we'll have to find, you'd have to find it somewhere else, and then you have to look at areas such as intensive supervision or sex offender treatment in the community or enhanced sex offender supervision. So whatever money doesn't get cut, if you just lower the reimbursement and keep some of that money for a lower reimbursement, it will have to come from somewhere.
Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair, no, my point would be that the state would get a higher reimbursement. So instead of cutting the program, you're getting more dollars from the locals and the counties. So instead of cutting the program from the state level, you're actually increasing the revenue, because if these locals see that as such a benefit that there's no way they could produce that for the same amount of dollars we could put back to the state, then we could keep the program intact and actually increase the revenue.
Mr. Chair and Representative, well, a higher reimbursement from the county just means a lower amount of funding that the state would have to provide. And the proposal is that the total amount of state funding is being eliminated. So, I mean, even if you increase the county reimbursement, you've still got to have some state money there for the balance.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kelly, go try one more time.
We have two sides of the equation. I understand we're talking about cuts to the from the program or from the state level, but if the counties are bringing in dollars to the state level, then we're offsetting that cut. Does that not
a cut? Mr. Mayor, is that a, I don't know. We've sort of
kind of. Okay, well, I'll leave it.
Mr. Chairman, I follow Representative Kelly's logic, and it's certainly something that could be looked at if the counties were willing to contribute a larger share, which I think is a big question, too.
Yeah. Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My first question is for Commissioner Crist on the MnCorps, which made me think of this after we were finished talking about it. Now, we're paying offenders pennies on the dollar compared to what a comparable industry would pay their workers. But we're not competitive to the tune of pennies on the dollars in terms of getting bidders on the products. So are the remainder of those costs absorbed by our security costs, or where does that money go, if you follow my question?
Commissioner Crist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, we pay our offenders in MnCorps on average about a dollar an hour to perform their jobs. Now, obviously, that's a lot less than prevailing wages would be in the community. We've got inherent inefficiencies built into operating a business within a prison. We've got to count the number of workers that are on those jobs several times a day. We've got to count all of the tools that we give them at the beginning of the day. We count them at lunchtime. We count them again at the end of the workday. In addition to production foremen, which any business would have, we've got security staff that are watching the workers. And so the money that we bring in from the MnCorps program goes back into the MnCorps program to provide jobs to offenders. Keeping offenders busy in a constructive assignment for 6 or 7 hours a day is inherently a good security practice. I think I said it in this committee the other day, nowhere is it more clear that idleness is the devil's workshop than in our prisons. And so while it doesn't seem like the dollars balance out, it does provide us a good program which contributes significantly to the security and the management of our facilities.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Chris. My next question relates to the health care piece we were discussing, and was it Nan Larson? Did I get the name right? Can you describe for me, well, first of all, before my question, Mr. Chair, I would like to support Ms. Larson's recommendation that we get free health care for our offenders and maybe loot Representative Huntley's budget to the tune of whatever we need to for health care, which would be very handy. But can you give me an idea, Ms. Larson, of what we're talking about? You said 33% of our health care is done off-site, and that was... We made a change with respect to the dialysis as well. You described ER runs. What percentage of the off-site health care are ER runs, and what percent are not? And can you give me a typical scenario of what is involved in transporting and taking care of an offender off-site? How many people, staff them, what's the transportation?
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, if I said 33%, that was wrong. We provide about 80% of our health care on-site, so about 20% is off-site. With respect to percent of ER runs, are you asking about cost, the percentage of cost? Because each ER run is about $4,000.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I'm looking, Ms. Larson, for a typical scenario of how many staff people have to be with that person, and what's the duration, what's the planning that goes into having to transport someone, that kind of thing.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, every time we take an offender off-site, that offender is, it's got a good beat.
I'd give it a six.
Every time we take an offender off-site, that offender is escorted by two officers at the very least. We try and group, whenever we do off-site runs, we try and group our offenders. So maybe if we have two offenders who are going to an oncology appointment, they might be escorted by three officers. But so every time they go off-site, it's always with at least two officers. They're in their orange jumpsuits and their shackles. When it's an ER run, we always call our on-call doc first to find out if this is something that needs to be, if this needs to go to the ER. If it's not during regular business hours, because if it's during regular business hours, we generally have a provider on site. We don't have 24-hour nursing at all of our sites.
I apologize for those budget cutbacks at the legislature.
No.
We don't have 24-hour nursing at all of our sites. We do have 24-hour nursing at two sites, at Oak Park Heights, where we have our transitional care unit, which is kind of like a subacute care facility. We do wound care. We do some IV therapy. We do pre- and post-surgical. We do hospice care there. And then also at Faribault, where we have our Linden unit that's kind of for our geriatric population, so folks that need 24-hour nursing monitoring. But we don't at the other sites. So when we have somebody who needs to go off-site during non-business hours, we'll call our on-call doc. The doc will say, yeah, he needs to go. No, he doesn't need to go. If he goes, we call the ambulance. Ambulance can get to us within 30 minutes. And then the officers travel with him. Sometimes a chase car will follow the ambulance, depending on the custody level of the offender, what's going on. And then they stay with him the entire time.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Larson, can you say, and I don't recall if you said this, but in your change, which allowed you to do dialysis on site, how much money did you save then per appointment, I don't know what you call a dialysis session, but how much money did you save?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lash, the cost of the dialysis, bringing the dialysis vendor on site, is about the same. What we're really saving is the security costs and the transportation costs. So we're saving two officers, 4 to 5 hours, three times a week for 10 to 12 offenders.
Do the
yeah.
math. I get it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Liebling. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I also had questions about the health care issue. First of all, I'm on the Health and Human Services Committee, so I have some understanding of what you're talking about with the medical assistance rates, but I doubt that most of the people here do. So maybe you could just give a bit more explanation of why you're saying that you don't want to pay Medicaid rates.
Sure.
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, thanks for giving me the opportunity to do that. Probably 10, 14 years ago, I think when it was the beginning of the Minnesota Care legislation, the legislature passed a statute requiring providers who took state employees, who took workers' compensation patients, to also take Medicaid enrollees. And there was considerable concern about access for Medicaid enrollees because of the low reimbursement rate. And of course, that reimbursement rate has not increased. It's probably around 45% to 50% of bill charges right now. So the legislature passed a statute, the Department of Human Services enacted what they call Rule 101, and Rule 101 requires providers to take Medicaid enrollees if they're going to take the state employees, workers' comp, et cetera. We have not taken advantage of our authority to reimburse at Medicaid rates because right now we have a hard enough time finding providers who will take our offender population. It's not really good business for them to have guys in orange jumpsuits and shackles on their wrists and ankles sitting in the waiting room with grandma and grandpa and mom and dad. So we have paid at a higher reimbursement rate. We still get a discounted rate. We're somewhere, between 70-75% of bill charges in most cases. But we could certainly, see some savings there. So if we were going to reimburse at Medicaid rates, we would need some statutory guarantee, like that Medicaid population, that if we're going to reimburse it, providers have to see our offender population. Because otherwise, we're never going to get in to see. We have a hard enough time seeing GI docs right now, for example. We have only one gastroenterologist who will see us. Thankfully, St. Joe's, the hospital in St. Paul, is where we provide most of our inpatient care. And they do it as part of their mission. We have, probably a 10-year relationship with them. But I know that if we start reimbursing them at MA rates, they will say goodbye to us.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for that explanation. That's helpful. Mr. Chair, I'm glad we got this sheet before I ask my question. Thank you for distributing this and, looking at what our average annual expenditure per inmate is in Minnesota according to this. And first of all, I just wanted to say that it's really hard when just to compare the numbers like this and have it be really meaningful. For example, I'm kind of curious how our age profile of our offenders might compare to other states, because that obviously is going to influence the cost per offender, as well as what the general cost for medical care is in the state, although I think that Minnesota is pretty economical compared to the other states. So that certainly, in my mind, wouldn't account for it. But Mr. Carger told me that he has data that the average cost per Minnesota resident for health care is $6,200, if I got that right, Mr. Carger. And I don't know what's involved, what's counted in that number and who all is in that number. And again, there are lots of factors that make that up. But I just kind of wanted to point out that this is certainly an area that would bear more exploration in terms of our ability to cut costs, but I just would want to make sure that we're looking at real stuff, and so we need to know, for example, what the inmate age you know, what are what the health picture looks like compared to other states, what the age picture looks like, so that we can get a meaningful comparison.
Ms. Larson, do you have anything more to add on that?
We can, Mr. Chair, we can certainly get some of those data. One of the points, however, that struck me just at first blush in looking at that, we include in our health care costs the cost of sex offender treatment, CD treatment, mental health, medical, nursing, and dental. So all of those are combined. I don't know what some of the other states include in theirs, but health services include all of those disciplines.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. We're gonna turn the system down for a second and see. Must have been Representative Reinhart.
That's good. I claim that.
Okay, is it back up again now? Okay, we'll see how that works. Representative Haas, then Cornish.
Thank you. As a past park director, I've dealt with this SDS program and community service programs quite extensively in order to get the job done. SDS programs were really beneficial because they have crew leaders that are talented, and then they oversee the crews, so you really get some efficient work done with that. But there's also a parallel program of community service where a judge will sentence a person to community service. Many of the jails, they could be sentenced to community service and put in jail or not put in jail. Sometimes when they're put in jail, the jail will release that individual to do that community service. So then it's almost parallel to the sentence to serve program. But they do not have a crew leader with them, so then it's a little shakier. It can be very good, but it's sometimes a little bit shaky. I once had a person that worked for me 10 hours a week for 4 years on a drug deal thing that was really a drug addict who was really a pretty good guy. He's the only one I thought we should give a gold watch to when he was done with his community service as a retirement. Where the unions do come in conflict is if there's a person laid off and you start using either volunteers into that position or a sentence to serve or community services into a laid off position and you're filling a position with those, then you usually are in violation of their union contract or they'll grieve that action. Normally, if you're just supplementing the work and helping them do the work, the unions are very happy to work with these programs. At least that's what I found over the years. So now the variable in here is if judges were aware when they're sentencing them now in a reduced STS, if they would shove them more into community service rather than the STS programs, that might help balance that need a little bit. So,
thank you. I think we'll take Representative Cornish and then move on. Oh, did you have a... To this point and to that point. Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Haas. I appreciate that. I guess when I was, as we were going through this discussion, I was thinking if this is only for county-based prisoners, then it would be to the interest of the county to make sure that they did not have to incarcerate them, that they actually didn't go against the county's bed count, and that for the judges to actually sentence to serve would be to the advantage of the county. And I'm not sure why the state has a compelling interest in this in the program by subsidizing half of it, other than to say it's a great program and we want to endorse it. So it seems to me that if we cut this program, it would still be in the county's best interest to not put those people in prison, but rather have the judge put them on a sentence to serve and then employ somebody at the county level to actually oversee the team. It would seem to me it would still be more beneficial to the county to have the program.
To this point, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to remind members of the committee that STS does count as a substitute for incarceration. If you get a certain number of days, you can get STS or electronic home monitoring. But community service does not count. And this committee, ET is phoning home again, Mr. Chair. This committee is fond of setting mandatory minimums for certain senses, including DWIs, etc., and a person cannot get community service for those. It has to be an incarceration alternative like STS. So, for the record, Mr. Chair.
Thanks. Senator Cornish, if you can get by the static.
Look, oh, yeah.
One moment, Commissioner Perez.
If you're packing, could you shoot that?
What's that?
Mr. Chair, members, I just want to say one more time that the offenders we're talking about for STS are offenders that would otherwise be serving time in a county jail. These are not offenders that would be coming to the Department of Corrections prisons, and so there is no effect on the tails of prison population as a result of this initiative.
Mr. Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, I, like most of you, have heard a lot about this SDS program. It sounds like that we'd like to keep that, and said something about finding revenue. I would like to know if we could crunch the numbers to drain all of the money for the SDS that we need out of the sex offender treatment program. I don't think we're doing them any good. I think we're locking them up and giving them treatment just for show so that we have an excuse to lock them up, which they should be. But I don't think there's any hope in rehabilitating, so I think we should take the money for the STS program out of the sex offender treatment, not so much out of the housing, but I would just be interested in crunching the numbers and finding out how much money goes into the actual treatment and if we could extract that money out of there and leave enough in for the dog and pony show that we think we're actually treating them to make it legal to keep them there. But if you know what I'm getting at, did we get those numbers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, are you talking about sex offender treatment that happens in Minnesota prisons or the sex offender treatment that happens in the Department of Human Services Minnesota sex offender program in Moose Lake?
Sex offender program in Moose Lake. Or any sex offender treatment that we are currently using that isn't doing any good, obviously, because we're not graduating anybody. Take that money and put it into the STS program, transfer it. If there's any way to do that or find out if that's available to do that.
Well, Commissioner Chris, if you want to answer that. Representative Cornish, I wish this legislature would have that very discussion. I couldn't agree with you more, but we won't because we're afraid to. And the system will just keep going on and on and on and on.
I think we can keep them locked up. I just have a problem with trying to treat them.
Mr. Merz?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, just to answer your question, we have approximately $2.4 million in for grants to for sex offender treatment in the community.
Representative Liebling, and then we really need to move on because we have two more presentations.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to respond to Representative Cornish briefly and just say, you know, Representative Cornish, these are the people in that program have finished their sentences. I mean, I know you understand this. You know, whether the treatment is actually doing them any good or not, that's one question. But if we're not treating them, we don't have authority to keep them there. That's the simple fact. We're keeping them there because we are treating them, quote unquote. If we're not really treating them, we have no justification for keeping them there. Now, maybe we should have had longer sentences to begin with way back when, but the fact is we didn't. So we have this problem right now. And Representative Paymar is absolutely right. We do have to have a frank discussion about how much we can do and how much bang for the buck we can get. But we're obviously not going to do that in the next 2 minutes.
Mr. Chair, I agree. I just think we should leave $150 in the account to go through the act of treating them so it makes it look like we're doing something so we can keep them locked up and take the money and use it where it really could be used. Because they need to be locked up forever regardless if their sentence is done. They're unlike any other individual.
Mr. Chair, briefly. Okay. Briefly, Representative. We really need to move
Thank
on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish. This is a public meeting, and I assure you that these comments will be used in the next lawsuit to show that we aren't really intent on treating them. So there's some things that you think but don't say.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner, Mr. Merz. We asked AFSCME and Representative from AFSCME and MAPE to please come forward and could you, Ms. Ms. Blau, you want to start?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you. And the cuts to STS that you've been discussing in the last few hours of the hearing here, I'd like to make something clear, and that is with regard to trash. The unions have been supportive of the Sentence to Service program and the Adopt a Highway program. That is the programs, they are the programs that pick up trash in the ditches. Our members through DOT will clear debris on the highways as part of road patrol. That's a necessary function, it's a safety function, but when it comes to the Sentence to Service program, we have been very supportive. We are also opposed to the cuts that the governor is proposing in the Sentence to Service program. I think there's roughly about 54 of our members that will be impacted by these cuts, and we're going to be having further discussions with the Department of Corrections later on this week. You've discussed here a number of ways of going about trying to come up with funds within the department. This budget, nothing is going to be easy. And we've been the organization that's gone on record supporting revenue for the state to try and backfill the holes. The hole is deep this year. The hole gets much deeper in the next biennium. But given the necessary function of public safety and the Department of Corrections and the programs that they provide, I think the discussion here speaks for itself as far as the quality and the service that it provides to the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Blau. Any questions? Mr. Kolodziejski.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity. And members, I am Richard Kolodziejski, the Legislative Affairs Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. Just to quickly go over some of the cuts that impact our members. First, in the area of community service reductions, the governor has outlined one FTE cut that could take place for processing grants and contracts, likely a MAPE member, and generally is in the other state agencies as well. The operating budget reductions, there's still not a lot of clarity as to where those will take place. There's a large proportionate amount of MAPE members' jobs that would be at risk. During this biennium, we have had some ITS jobs cut, and without clarification from the department, I'm certainly not in a position to give any estimate on job loss in that area. The transfer from the MinCorp programs, that's where I've received the most feedback from our members. Rumors being what they are, the discussion inside that agency, if you will, is that there's going to be mass layoffs as a result of this. So it's nice to have that opportunity to hear the department say, in fact, that this will not result in specific layoffs, and the cuts will be done through attrition. And finally, the transfer from the Special Revenue Fund. The cuts outlined there include the programming from Togo. That's most likely going to come from our bargaining unit. There's 16 MAPE members up at Togo. They range from caseworkers to programming staff for the kids in that facility, and those are our main two classifications that are represented up at Togo. So, Mr. Chair, members, I would just remind everybody that at a time when jobs are critical, this plan clearly is going to send some people to the streets and leave them unemployed. This is not something that's going to be done through attrition. The department has laid off individuals in IT alone, and I don't know how they can continue to make cuts without. So.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, I guess one of the issues that we're dealing with here at the legislature is an ever-increasing budget, obviously, in terms of revenue going out. One of the things I think to consider is the fact that in the private sector, job revenues have actually decreased by about 5%, and yet under some of the corporate bargain agreements, the steps and lanes are continuing to be implemented at the union level. The solution lies particularly with the bargaining units and per se you. So my question to you is, are you willing to help participate in this resolution of this budget rather than laying off by freezing steps and lanes, by saying, okay, in the next 2-year biennium, we're willing to take some drastic actions and say, you know what, everybody's suffering in the private sector, we as a union are willing to participate.
Mr. Kolodziejski.
Mr. Chair, members, I think I could speak for both bargaining units here at the table. We didn't take across-the-board increases in our last collective bargaining agreement. There are step increases in the second year only for those who are eligible. That's based on performance. I believe, and I'm just going to give you an estimate, that there's approximately half of our employees that are represented in state service that are even eligible for that. And beyond that, neither Ms. Blyle or myself participate in the collective bargaining process with the state of Minnesota, the governor's team, or on behalf of our labor unions. But we certainly have in the past. This is the earliest settlement we had, which was on our last contract. That'll be before you this session. And I think we played a significant role in trying to keep those costs down to a minimum.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to that point, when we had some meetings together with our local communities, part of their resolutions were they were in tight budgets, and they were saying we are compelled by the bargaining labor agreements that we can't contain the costs, and the unions are coming basically to us with steps and lanes, of which have been mandated down here at the legislature. And if there's anything you can do at the legislature to try and freeze these things to help us get our budgets within control, please do that. And so that's why I bring that up here, not just in terms of your two units, but in terms of the unions at large. We're in a crisis situation here. We got a $1.2 billion budget shortfall. Local communities can't balance their budget. We're cutting their LGA, and yet their corporate bargaining agreements are coming to the table with steps and lanes as a given. And so I think all of those things need to be on the table in terms of how do we bring this budget into control, and part of that process is the steps and lanes freeze consideration.
Ms. Blau.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Severson, I'd just like to comment that the negotiations process for the state involves the gubernatorial administration together with the unions. The agreement that was reached was agreed to by the current governor. With regard to the counties, the salary settlements are all over the map, but virtually zero, zeros, and zeros. There haven't been a lot of salary increases. The cuts in health insurance, the increased out-of-pockets. In some cases, there have been changes made with regard to their retirement. As we go forward here, nothing's easy, but it isn't up to the legislature to negotiate the contracts, and it isn't up to us as representatives of the organization that represent the organization at the legislature to be involved in a negotiating session. This is something that needs to take place at the negotiations table, not in a committee room. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Stevenson.
And to that point, I represent a district, and that district has cities, and those city administrators have a voice. And that's the voice you're hearing at this table right now. Mm-hmm. That's not the voice of a legislator. That's my city officials speaking to the union saying, give us some relief. Mm-hmm. So whether that comes from the governor's office in terms of the bargaining process makes no difference to me. My voice is the voice of my constituents telling you that they need some relief.
Representative Olin. Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, to either the testifiers, 10 years ago, when the private sector was seeing some pretty large pay hikes, did your members participate in a level of those pay hikes to the extent that the private sector did?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh.
Ms. Blau.
To my knowledge, no. If we look back, there was a salary sup, and I'm thinking it's 2010 now. It was probably 2004. Approximately 3 years ago, that there was a salary cep that was put into the biennial budget. But for the most part, no, the salary settlements in this state have either been zeros in the last few years or very, very small numbers compared to what we saw in the private sector as being a lot larger salary increases.
And Mr. Chair, just by way of comment, I think everyone around this table probably knows that during the boom years when the private sector was drawing unprecedented profits and much of that matched salaries or bonuses, public employees did not see that. That's because government should be stable. It shouldn't spike and have the mass fluctuations that the private sector does. Similarly, in a downturn, in order to keep government stable, you shouldn't bleed the public sector in the same way that there is a market correction in the private sector. So I think that should be kept in mind. There's no question that our public employees should participate, but there's no reason that we should force them into the same precarious economic situation that the public sector, that the private sector has found itself in.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell the committee at this point?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. I'd remind the committee that these are just the governor's recommendations, and if you don't care for some of the governor's recommendations, I hope that you bring to the table some other suggestions for possible cuts, and keep in mind that our target may be different than this, and we might have to make deeper cuts than this, and none of this is going to be easy, so I hope that you're thinking about where we might, how we might look at the entire DOC budget within the confines of this division. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just, that just reminded me, of course, that when you say that this, our actual target might be deeper, you know, the governor's budget is about a third money that doesn't really exist. So, in fact, the cuts that he's proposing in order to really balance the budget without any revenue, they do have to be much deeper than this. So that is I just want to say that's a very good point. I mean, what we're looking at here is just, you know, this is the best case, absolutely the best case.
Okay, we've asked community corrections folks to, I don't know how many people are here, but if you would like
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Paymar, members, my name is Ryan Erdman. I'm the Director and Legislative Liaison for the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties. We're the Association of Community Corrections Directors for all 17 community corrections jurisdictions representing 32 counties in Minnesota. To start off with, I was asked to speak a little bit to what has happened from previous budget sessions. I would be remiss if I didn't actually offer a word of thanks to you, Mr. Chair, and to the committee. Last time around, the pass-throughs were cut 0.88%, so slightly less than 1%, and in light of the overall budget situation, that was fairly favorable, quite favorable to our community corrections jurisdictions. It is not without pain when you consider some of the cuts that came from outside this community's, this committee's jurisdiction, county program aid cuts and other things. Counties did see some significant pain. Mostly through attrition, there are less jobs in community corrections than there have previously, 20 positions in Ramsey County alone. Other counties have kept most of their people on board, but have done things like cutting the Family Court Services Unit, which is a unit that provides various services to family court. It's relatively a program unique to the metro area counties. But those are the sorts of decisions counties have had to make in light of this coming from the previous biennial budget that was proposed. Moving on to the cuts, the only impact, and has been discussed at great length here, so I don't have a lot to add on the sentencing to service. Most of the CCA jurisdictions participate in sentence to service. There are a couple that don't. And they participate at varying levels. In Hennepin County, for example, there are 32 STS work crews, of which two are funded with state money. So the effect in that case is going to be relatively minimal. In others, it is in fact a 50% reduction in the STS program in those counties. And it's going to be a decision that the county has to make as to whether or not they have the ability to backfill that half if they run a program at sort of a half speed, which is viable in many jurisdictions. But the impact clearly will be felt by the local jurisdictions that are using these services, and work that would not get done otherwise will continue to not get done. The one comment I would make with regard to STS is it's generally felt, and I've talked to nearly all of the corrections directors that I work for, that cuts to targeted programs, if the alternative is there is going to be a cut to counties. Now, if the cut comes from elsewhere, obviously we would prefer to keep this STS program fully intact. But if there is going to be a cut to counties, cuts to targeted programs make it much easier for counties to manage than, say, a cut to the CCA subsidy, which is flexible dollars, because it allows the county if they value STS highly, to maintain the STS program, even if the cut comes in that area. However, if targeted programs are left intact and the overall subsidy is the only thing that takes a cut, we're put in a box of keeping the programs for some of the lower-risk offenders and potentially having to affect our services and our caseloads for our probation officers for higher-risk offenders. So it's not... It's not something we would like to see. We would love for the sentencing service program to maintain the current level of funding. But if a cut is going to come to us, there are some advantages versus some of the alternatives. With that, I would stand for any questions.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Edmund, for your testimony. We did say that we would offer an opportunity for public. Oh, Ms. Walker? It's not. Are you, did you want to address the committee? No, please do. I'm sorry. I didn't know there was anyone else here.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the chair and the committee for having me here. I was asked to come on behalf of MCA, and Cal Sari sends his regrets. As I stated, I'll be very brief. Cal actually asked me to testify to offer a community perspective. As you probably know, the Minnesota Corrections Association represents a broad constituency of corrections professionals, including community-based organizations. I am the chief operating officer at 180 Degrees, which has been providing correctional services and operates a licensed correctional facility for the past 38 years. Amongst our responsibilities is we operate a halfway house for high-risk offenders. In addition, I'm also the founder of the Second Chance Coalition, which is a broad-based group that works with over 48 community service agencies throughout greater Minnesota. And I'm just here to offer support of maintaining or doing what we can to maintain services and programmings within the institutions. I would like to give an example. When clients are referred to us from the Department of Corrections, they're given 30 days to find a job and 60 days to find housing. When programming is cut in the Department of Corrections, when inmates are unable to do productive things, it makes our job as community service providers that much more difficult. And so I'm just here to offer testimony and answer any questions about a community-based perspective from the public safety budget cuts.
Questions? I don't believe so at this time, Ms. Walker, but thank you for your testimony. We said we would offer some time at the end of this meeting to any member of the community that would like to address the committee on the proposed cuts to the Department of Corrections or the past cuts to the Department of Corrections. Would you please give your name for the record?
For the record, I'm Janet Graves, RDHBS. As the first dental hygienist to work in our state's only maximum security prison at Oak Park Heights, I attained the distinction of being the only national certified corrections health provider in Minnesota State Corrections, a designation which identifies me as one who has demonstrated mastery of national standards and the knowledge expected of leaders working in the field of correctional health care. Since Minnesota prisons have lost accreditation, it's more important forever for the legislature to exercise their authority of oversight over the DOC. In my expert opinion, the current situation in dental health services does not meet ethical or legal standards, but most disturbingly, is fiscally irresponsible. Given that evidence-based research links oral disease to systemic health problems, prevention and timely treatment of dental infection are crucial to maintain overall health and save money in the long run. Prior to the beginning of the 2009-2010 fiscal year, and just days after the legislature adjourned, Health Services Director Nan Larson slashed the dental care budget. Her decision was made in complete defiance of the legislature and the governor's funding decisions. Why did Nan Larson do this? I have my own suspicions. Perhaps a better question to ask is exactly where did that $1.24 million appropriated to maintain dental services go? Simply put, Nan Larson's behavior doesn't pass the stink test. I don't buy the argument that DOC Assistant Commissioner Lisa Cornelius made when she said, we wouldn't want the budget to be too specific. This agency needs budget flexibility. This situation isn't about budget flexibility. It's about accountability. It's monies appropriated for services promised. The discussion last spring was extensive. The conference committee's decision was clear. And yet the dental services were cut before this fiscal cycle even had a chance to begin. Restoring preventative and urgent dental services does not add to the state's budget deficit. It's simply directing the DOC to spend the money as appropriated by the legislature, the group given the charge of overseeing this agency in the first place. I agree with Representative Hillstrom and Representative Coles. A legislative audit is long overdue for this agency. You know, it's been said that true ethical behavior happens when you think no one is looking. In the future, I suggest keeping a closer eye on the DOC, where the Health Services Director ignores and defies the decisions of the legislature. The DOC doesn't like to play by the rules. The choice is clear. Mandate the DOC to restore those preventative and urgent dental services as appropriated. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Graves. Representative Olin, did you have a question of the testifier or a comment, General?
Comment directly on this.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My comment directly on this was I distinctly remember the debate discussion last year on this particular subject, and I agree 100% with what you're saying. I do come with a slight bias, I must admit, because my wife is a 35-year certified dental assistant, so I'm well familiar with prevention being the way to go, and the actions that were taken last year are, by the DOC are beyond my comprehension, and they are totally unacceptable.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Graves. Ms. Larson, do you want to comment? I'm not going to...
Excuse me, that's really most unfortunate for me to hear this, because she was, not Commissioner Fabian, she was single-handedly responsible for that decision in defiance of the legislature. So I think it would be interesting to...
That's okay. I'm not going to compel her to testify.
Okay. Well, that's unfortunate.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like in future testimony, if we could not name people individually, it sounds more like a vendetta than if we could just keep it about the agency, it would really be nice, and the program.
Perhaps it would be advisable, Commissioner Crist, to maybe put in writing to the committee, and we can discuss this as our budget deliberations continue, an explanation to how those decisions were made, since it was indeed the committee's... desire to maintain that dental programming at that status level, regardless of the governor's recommendations. But we can take that up at a later day. I don't want to turn this into a something that I don't want to turn it into. Representative Lubring and then Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think my question was really answered. I really would like to have some answer from the department and not just leave it like that. So I would appreciate that, getting that in writing.
Thank you. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for being late. I was being heavily lobbied by the Carver County District Court. The judges venued in Carver County this morning with my colleague, Representative Hoppe, about funding for the courts. And I apologize for being late. I'm just curious, as we talk about the cost of dental care and other service costs, I see there was a handout. I'm just curious where it came from. I find the numbers on here very interesting. As I look at it, Minnesota is maybe third in terms of per inmate costs. I'm just curious where it came from.
We had quite the discussion, Mr. Carver provided.
I need to rehash it. I'm just wondering where it...
Yeah. We'll get you an update on it, because we had quite a discussion on it earlier and...
Did you hand it out, Mr. Chair?
I did.
Okay,
it was
great. Thank
Mr.
you.
Carver.
Thank you.
Representative Olin, another comment?
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, but when they, not really a comment, but to instruction, when you do give us an explanation as to what happened with rental money, I'd like to know exactly what happened with $1.2 million.
Commissioner, thank you. Can provide that? Okay, thank you. Representative, we can take this up again. I mean, is this Representative Ward?
That was my question.
Okay. So you can see the committee has quite an interest in this, Commissioner, so you'll provide us with that information. Is there any, are there any other questions, comments at this time? Thank you all for your testimony. This meeting's wait. Sorry. Could I have a motion to approve the minutes of February 18th? Representative Reinhart moves those minutes. Are there any discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Any other questions? We have a joint meeting, salary members, this afternoon at what time? What time? 1 o'clock. And is this the public? This is the legislative auditor's report on the public defenders here in this room. Thank you, members.